Welcome to the Jazz Legends podcast, which was born out of the Jazz Evensong gatherings on Sunday nights at St. Michael's by the Sea in Carlsbad, California. In addition to being one of the denizens of the New York City 52nd Street scene, pianist-composer Lenny Tristano was an influential and pioneering teacher of jazz improvisation. He had prodigious technical abilities as a player, and his pedagogical approach to teaching improvisation eschewed learning licks in favor of creating fresh, original, improvised music. His many compositions exhibit this somewhat stream-of-consciousness approach, uniquely original, often angular lines based on standard chord progressions. His linear approach to playing was championed by his best-known students, saxophonists Lee Konitz and Warren Marsh, who utilized his concepts for their entire careers. The knowledgeable jazz musicians you'll hear are Gunnar Biggs, Keith Bishop, Joey Carano, Leonard Thompson, and Bob Weller. And the talk is moderated by me, your host, Father Doran Stambaugh. Dig it.
I was working a show at La Jolla Playhouse, and they were having an after-performance gala kind of thing. Somebody came over to me and said, are you the bass player that played with Mose Allison? And I said, yeah, I did. What, this is weird, you know, at this thing. He says, well, he'd like to speak to you. Bring him over. And it was from The Who.
Pete Townsend.
It was, yeah. Pete Townsend. Sorry. Wow. And I said, oh, wow, Pete Townsend, how are you doing? He says, you played with Mose. He was our mate. And I said, you know, so we sat down. He says, come sit. So we sat down there. And I said, where do you come down on Mose's piano-wise? Because Mose had a different quirky piano thing. He said, directly from Lenny Tristano. He says, I hear Tristano in Mose's playing all the time. But I want to see if I can find any derivatives on that. But it was Pete Townsend. I mean, the people were coming over for his autograph, and he's going, bugger off, I'm speaking to my mate.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes he does those two-hand things.
Yeah, right.
And Mose does that all the time, but I don't see the connection at all.
But I hear more of the blues kind of thing from, plus Mose was a trumpet player to begin with, so not a piano player. Yeah. But that was my brush with a famous-y kind of guy, man. Yeah.
Well, Tristano was a friend of Bird's. Bird used to come over and hang out with Tristano.
I know that they played together, so they hung together.
Apparently they were friends, which seems a little weird because Tristano was sort of trying an anti-bop. He didn't want anybody to play those licks. He didn't want anyone to be that influenced by that style of playing.
He was anti-bop?
Well, I think he realized that Bird was like so creative and so original that he thought everybody trying to ape that was bad for the music. I think that was sort of part of his thing, and he wanted people to not do that. I know when I took a lesson from Lee Konitz, who was a disciple of Tristano's, he was on my case about, don't play that, do this to get away from playing that. Don't do that. Play a whole thing of fifths now. Just so you get away from that language that you play. And I guess that's a way of doing it, you know. And you have to give him credit. He did get away from that language himself. I didn't really like what he did with it a lot of times, but it was different.
Yeah, I think, I've been fascinated by hearing some interviews. There's some, you know, easy-to-find interviews with Lenny. And he basically says that when he did get this chance to play with Bird, he basically thought Bird decided to give me a chance because he knew I was doing something that wasn't copying him, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really insightful.
Yeah, I heard him say that as well. That was awesome. And it seems like he really loved Charlie Parker and he really loved Bud Powell, Everybody else he didn't so much love. And he said that he doesn't have proof of it. I heard it in an interview, but he said Charlie Parker at the end wanted to put a group together with him and try to push in another direction.
Right,
That's what Lenny
Tristano doesn't
said.
Surprise me at all.
Yeah. So how about some biographical insight on this guy? Like, where was he from? What's he known for? What are some of the tunes he wrote? What's his style like?
His tunes are pretty esoteric for the most part.
That's what I keep coming up with. It was very intellectual to me. It was very, and so was the tenor player.
Warren Marsh?
Warren Marsh also. Very intellectual. And sort of dry, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I lived in New York, he was no longer performing, but he was a well-known teacher.
I think he made most of his living over the years as a teacher, because so many people I know have studied with him.
He was the guy in the 80s in New York that every piano player wanted to study with. So, yeah. But he wasn't performing as far as I know. I never saw him perform.
He had amazing technique, though.
Yeah.
Amazing, yeah. And I do think of Lenny Tristano's music as being pretty close to bebop. The lines are long. I hear this Bach influence, you know, that is present. And I don't think it's too very different from Charlie Parker, except, you know, taking liberties more with putting 3/4, 5/4, and then doing these kind of elongated things. And,
right.
But I really love it, and I'm challenged by it. I think it's awesome.
I think, like, the process, I mean, he was certainly interested in playing over changes, and he just said, why not, you know, give yourself the tools to do it your own way? You don't have to copy anyone else's vocabulary, right? But, yeah, like, a lot of his recorded stuff is they're playing over the forms of tunes that we all know, and they, you know, he wrote lines to these tunes, these really slippery, you know, contrafacts that they all play very well executed together, and they're playing over forms, and that's like one part of his output. And then there's the free thing that Joey talked about, and that's something that maybe gets overlooked because it's probably not as much recorded as some of the other stuff, but he was very, from what I'm learning, super interested in playing, for lack of a better word, free music. But the way he wanted it to work was there had to be a lot of rigor in it. So he didn't want to leave anything up to chance. And, like, the, you know, everyone had to be listening to one another, and the harmony had to be, like, tracking. And you know, there had to be, like, a symbiosis going on at all times. So I guess his free thing had some really, like, kind of, I don't know, maybe strict standards, whereas he would talk about other free music, and maybe he didn't drop any names, but he thought a lot of free music that he heard during this time, you know, was kind of BS. And so I'd be curious to know what he thought of Ornette, because I think there was, you know, definitely some rigor to what Ornette was doing, and that was free in another way. I don't know.
It's also interesting that he really disliked folks that were coming right out of Charlie Parker, but that crew, they had a lot of the same vocabulary. Yeah, you know, Warren Marsh, Dick Konitz. I almost said the name of a friend of mine, Lee Konitz. Props, Dick Koenig. But they had a lot of crossover, those folks. And maybe that had something to do with why Lee Konitz and Warren Marsh took off. They maybe realized, hey, I need to do my own thing because this guy is so powerful.
I mean, and part of his teaching, Lenny's teaching thing, apparently, everything you read about it, was that a big part of studying with him was being able to sing along with all the great solos. So that's probably where all the vocabulary might come in when you hear his disciples and cohorts and things like that. But I still think that, I mean, gosh, you know, Warren Marsh has become one of my favorite players. Like with a lot of other great guys, you can definitely see that there's history there into what they've listened to. But man, he sounds like himself to me. And it doesn't sound like regurgitating vocabulary to me. And Konitz doesn't sound like that to me either. It's like, it's just enough of like acknowledging what came before you, but not being afraid to put a different spin on it. And that's some of my favorite stuff anyway.
He's a pianist and a composer. So as a piano player, like, what are your thoughts on his playing, on his style? What's interesting or unique?
The more I learn about him, he's just like basically an incredible force of nature who's like operating on all cylinders and insanely competent on in many different ways, be it like rhythm, you know, harmony, linear concept, sound, just everything. He didn't, you know, there were no, you know, it's hard to find weak areas of his playing to me. But it's just, he left sort of a mystery behind because of him not being like super well recorded. He had his own things about not wanting to record a lot because he didn't want record companies to have a lot of control over things. So we never quite know what like, if we're getting an accurate piece of Lenny Tristano, you know, when we look at the big picture. But it's always fun to, you know, when more recordings surface, it's always fun to like round out the picture of someone, like, as time goes on. Like, some of these live things were, like, he would have, you know, Lee Konitz and Warren Marsh just playing a duet, like, playing a Bach fugue together. So that's a whole nother, like, oh, that was, like, he was into that, you know? But, yeah, a lot of the things that you might hear him if you just type in Lenny Tristano are a lot of, like, right hand forever and not a lot of left hand if you're not careful. But, man, he certainly didn't lack confidence in his left hand. And then if you hear the right stuff, you'll hear, like, you can hear him on one track, like, you know, for several choruses in a row, like, comping with his right hand and playing, like, an extended linear solo in his left hand, like, and he could have kept doing that for days. Like, all of his muscles were well exercised, I think, you know, conceptually and technically, and super serious, you know, about being a badass, you know. that's my take on it.
You mentioned Free several times. Maybe you should have asked this question when we did Ornette, but for anyone who doesn't know what that means in relationship to jazz, aside from not paying for it. Want to take a crack at, like, a musical definition of what is meant by free?
Well, generally departing from just playing on chord changes, and to a certain extent departing from just playing on modes, like, so that the mode isn't really established beforehand. You just listen to each other and try and play stuff that makes sense with what everyone else is playing. And it only works if people can actually play their instruments and actually listen to each other, which is part of the problem with some of the stuff in the 60s. These guys were not schooled enough to be able to play themselves or listen and be able to fit what they're playing in with what some of the other people were playing. And it ended up sounding like disorganized noise, because it sort of was.
Yeah.
And most of those guys, I don't think anyone's listening to these days. There was a handful of players, you know, like the people that came up around Ornette and some other players from that era that came up that actually could play and made that style work.
Yeah. So maybe some of it was too free.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the guys that came up before them were influenced by them. Like Sonny Rollins was influenced by Ornette, and so was Coltrane, and pushed them in that direction. Coltrane more than Sonny Rollins, I think, towards the end. And I have to wonder if Coltrane had lived longer, if he wouldn't have come back around to playing more inside than he was playing when he passed away. Because it was sort of searching for that thing.
Mm-hmm. So Lenny Tristano also, he played free.
Well, supposedly those records that you mentioned were the first free jazz records. Yeah, they were like in the late 40s, I think. He made those records with Lee and with Warren. That was supposedly, I think there were two on that one record that were supposedly free.
And it still sounds like Lenny Tristano music.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It doesn't sound free in the way that we were talking about Ornette.
It's more cerebral sounding than Ornette stuff.
They're playing specific intervals, and they're working with the others. And I don't know if they're thinking about a structure or if they're just so used to these certain structures and they go with it.
I worked with George Lewis, the trombone player who's now teaching at Columbia. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant.
Uh-huh.
And we did a lot of free playing, and we did a lot of free playing in a large ensemble, like 20 people, 15 or 20 people. And he would think, you know, that would be mayhem. But he said something to us that I remember to this day. He said, well, just imagine you're in an orchestra. How often are you going to play if you're in a full orchestra? A lot of the time you're going to be laying out. You're not going to be playing anything. He said, so just listen and try to
pick
play,
your spots,
you know, like in a way that is not, it's not too much for the texture. So when we started listening that way, it made a lot more sense.
And that's one of the most insightful sort of things I've heard about advice on, like, how to play freely.
Every time I hung out with him, I learned something new. You know, he really deserved that MacArthur Genius Grant.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he really was something.
Yeah, sometimes with free playing, form is defined by the lack of form. So what you have to do is listen, would inspire me to do something, would take me in a different direction, which might take Joey in a different direction, which would influence what Leonard does. So that lack of form all of a sudden becomes a communication feedback loop kind of thing.
I think you also have to be ready to be totally spontaneous, you know, like not think at all, not plan anything, have no agenda. Yeah. You just have to go for it.
And deal with silence.
It's like a community solo.
That's what it is.
There is. Yeah. It's very akin to what the New Orleans players do a lot of times. When they're just all the horns are blown at the same time, clarinet's listening to the trombone, who's listening, you know, it's and to a certain extent, Mose Allison, he never wanted two and four on the hi-hat. He would fire drummers that played the backbeat on the hi-hat because he wanted it to be 1-1-1-1-1. So wherever he put what he was doing, you played with him with us.
Well, I played with him, and you know, he told me, don't play on two and four with a hi-hat. So I got used to not playing on two and four. And the next gig I did was with Herb Ellis. It was Herb Ellis. And so after the first set, Herb came over to me and said, do you mind playing the hi-hat on two and four?
Just got off a gig with Mose.
Yeah, but that would change everything that we did because it was just 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. So in terms, I'm hearing more about Lenny Tristano that makes more sense for what Pete Townsend was saying with just rambling. I mean, he would, it would be structureless, but we could play anything we want. He'd stay on one chord for a while, then he would play chords and stuff, but he would really voice them differently.
You know, you could only, I mean, I was there with you on that gig, and he could only do that because you knew that you had to go with him, whatever he decided to do. I thought you nailed it. Like, you just, he would go in one direction, and you'd be right there with him, knowing exactly what he was going to do.
Played with him for years.
I was totally out to sea for a long time.
Most drummers are for the first time.
Yeah.
The two and four thing kills most drummers. But I think that's another thing about free playing. You cannot say, there's one. You know, it doesn't come around every four beats. It could be just ones. And that restricts, you know, when you have that kind of metric restriction, that restricts what you can do melodically and harmonically, too, because you have to adhere to something like that. You'd get rid of that, and things just branch out.
Maybe that's interesting, because Tristano was kind of famously anti-drummer, too.
Really?
He would want the drummer to do as little as possible.
Yeah, Mose's thing was, I hate the best drummers in New York.
Nice.
A couple interesting things from this Downbeat interview with Lenny Tristano. It's from October of 1950. And one of the things that he shares is the connection between jazz and its popularity or lack thereof and what's happening in the nation and the world. He says, everybody in this country is very neurotic now. It's 1950. They're afraid to experience an intense emotion, the kind of intense emotion, for instance, that's brought on by good jazz. There's more vitality in jazz than in any other art form today. Vitality arises from an emotion that is free. But the people, being neurotic, are afraid of being affected by a free emotion, and that's why they put down jazz. And then the interviewer goes on, eventually, when the atmosphere becomes more relaxed, Lenny thinks people will pick up on jazz. But conditions being what they are, he foresees as much as a decade of emotional tension that will keep jazz from gaining public acceptance again.
When was this?
That was 1950. So in 1960, wow. Did it pick up?
And we're still waiting.
We're still waiting.
We're in, you know, big, I was thinking 52nd Street was really going in 1950, wasn't it? Wasn't 52nd Street really cranking and all the bebop clubs and
Lenny was working down there.
Yeah.
To that point, so that was the other thing I wanted to share. I think it's 52nd Street. You guys tell me. Birdland?
Yeah.
Is that 52nd Street? Okay.
It was back then.
Back then.
A bunch of different locations.
Okay. So the ideal way, they describe a gig that happened. The ideal way to present jazz to the public, according to Lenny, is to follow the format of the opening show at Birdland last winter. So this would have been maybe still 1950 or 1949. That show exhibited the major elements of jazz and included Max Kaminsky's Dixie group, blues shouting a la Hot Lips Page, Lester Young's combo as a bow to the swing era, Charlie Parker's bop outfit, and Lenny and his Tristanos. What a show.
Yeah, and you used to be able to go in there for like a dollar and sit in the bleachers all night.
So he says, that was a wonderful show until it got loused up by a word-happy MC. That's pretty funny.
Pee-wee Marquette.
Was it really?
That was who was the MC at at the old Birdland.
Yeah.
You used to have to tip him to get him to pronounce your name right.
He said, for the first few nights, I was very happy. Before we opened, I was afraid that some of the Dixie fans might boo Parker or the boppers might put down Max, but everybody was very happy.
Well, they used to do a lot of that, even in up through the 60s. They used to have these concerts where they'd have like almost like it was a battle of the bands.
Well, it's only 1950, so the history isn't as long as it is now. But that to me feels like this little sweep of the history of jazz music.
Just the fact that they had like four bands in one night, that's like conspicuous consumption. I remember one of the first times I was in New York, I went to the went to a club that had two different bands, so it was confusing. And that was like, wow, how do they do that? You know,
yeah.
But having four bands on the same bill.
What are some of his? Does he have tunes that are in the canon?
We're going to play a lot of them on Sunday. Yeah,
yeah.
They're sort of niche things because unless you're hip to Lenny Tristano, you probably haven't heard the tunes.
So no big name.
No.
Not anything popular.
Anything that you'll hear of his that's a tune, quote unquote, is going to be a contrafact over a standard. So he didn't. Yeah, he didn't write anything.
The closest thing to a standard song is one called Lenny's Pennies, which is Pennies from Heaven in a minor key. And it's an obtuse melody. All of them are obtuse melodies. You'll hear what I mean. We played a lot of these last year when we did a Lenny Tristano program.
I think by his own words, he basically wanted any quote-unquote tune of his, wanted it to sound as much like an improvisation as it could. So all these squirrely lines that are, you know, Lenny Tristano heads, they're really, you know, I think when he sent those out into the world to whatever degree he did, he wanted them to be just as robust as like, you know, any one of the most adventurous of his improvisations on a tune, I think was his goal. As I understood it, you know.
Don't we think that Charlie Parker heads are the same?
Yeah, for sure.
It's a great lesson into Charlie Parker's trip into his brain. You know, that's what he was thinking over this
for sure.
Chord change.
Yeah, it was really the awesome. Same process, wasn't it? It was all contrafacts. That's Bird stuff.
For our listeners, want to explain a contrafact? What a contrafact
you,
is?
You can.
Oh, I'll give it a try. Oh, I'll see if I can do it.
Doran.
Taking a tune, say, from Tin Pan Alley, and these guys would jam them, and then they'd want to go out and play them and maybe even record them. However, because of publishing rights and so forth, they couldn't necessarily do that. So they would take the same chord changes but write different melodies over the chord changes because you can't copyright chord changes.
There you go. All
right. So you're saying a lot of Parker's tunes – are contrafacts.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
How many I Got Rhythms are there?
In fact, I think Lenny, I heard Sheila Jordan and maybe also Warren Marsh saying that right off the bat, Lenny would say, you need to learn this Charlie Parker, sing this Charlie Parker line, choose this one. And I think it was Sheila Jordan that said, Lenny asked me to do this Charlie Parker line on Embraceable You, and same interview. And she knew it already, so Lenny was knocked out.
The Evensong Quintet will feature the music of pianist-composer Lenny Tristano on March 24th, starting at 4 p.m. The weekly Jazz Evensong gatherings are free and open to the public and take place Sundays at 4 p.m. at St. Michael's-by-the-Sea in Carlsbad, California. See you there.